to enhance the sound in my telephone.
Oh, okay.
I have trouble upstairs. I don't hear too well. My wife hears too well, and I don't hear well enough.
Okay, Rene. As I we talked about in person and on emails, this is a project for the Naval War College.
Yeah.
I had a Vietnam elective.
The one who were very nice, nice to give me some advice and then say, we're not interested in your book.
No. In fact, that's the other thing I wanted to mention. Aside from this interview, they want to bring you out, I think in the spring, they'll fly you from Indianapolis to...
They will?
To Newport, yes, sir, to give a lecture. Oh. I don't know how big the class will be, maybe 20, 30 people at most.
Oh, that's good.
But to interview you and talk to you. And but aside from that, they wanted to do this project where I have to interview someone who served in Indochina and Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And this is tape recorded. And then it's transcribed, and it goes into the Naval War College archives for future students to review.
Yeah.
So we can begin. Just for the record, today is the 23rd of November, 2005. My name is Stephen Weidman, Stephen Weidman. I'm a student at the Naval War College. And you, sir, you are Rene J. DeForno?
Correct.
And that's R-E-N-E, middle initial J, last name spelled D-E. F-O-U-R-N-E-A-U-X.
Correct.
And you retired as a major in the U.S. Army, sir?
Yes.
When did you retire?
I retired in February 1965.
Now, how many times did you serve in Indochina or Vietnam?
Oh, in Indochina or Vietnam? Well, during the war, I was there in 1945. Then I returned back there in 1958.
My goodness.
And then I was there until 1963.
So the second time, 1950 to 1963.
Actually, I was in 57. I was there in 57. And then I came back. I was in Southeast Asia consecutively for 7 years.
My goodness. Okay. And the first time you went, you were attached in 1945.
I was with OSS.
You were with the OSS. What detachment was that, sir?
Oh, I don't know what it.
Oh, the reason why I'm asking, I'm not familiar, but I guess when we went to the reunion, it was Detachment 101, which is.
No, not Detachment 101. No, I don't remember the name of the detachment. Detachment 101 was strictly for Burma.
Right.
They were their headquarters was in Assam. I was there with them for a while.
Oh, my goodness, you were all over the place.
I was supposed to go to Burma, and they changed their mind, and they flew me across the hump to Kunming. And then, because they had some French refugees in southern China, they wanted me to handle. Oh, to see what they were doing there.
Well, let's, depending on how much time you have, I'd like to hear all of it. Let's start with your first time that you were in Indochina in 1945. If you can remember the dates, approximate dates that you were there.
The exact date, I do not remember.
Well, the war...
I'm going to tell you, I was celebrating my birthday in Chaboa, India, which was the 29th of April, and I've been there for a couple of months. So I probably got there in February.
Okay, and the
I left the state, I think, in February and got to... We flew from, that was a long trip. Instead of going across the Pacific, we could not do it. We had to go through South America first, across the Atlantic, and stop at the Ascension Island, Africa, then Saudi Arabia, then Saudi Arabia to what is now Pakistan, which was still India in those days.
Sure, it's part of the Raj.
Karachi. This is one of my first stop in Asia was Karachi.
Oh, my goodness.
And from Karachi, they sent me to Ceylon because they thought they would need me over there. I don't know what it was, but anyway, I spent there some time, and I was just about to go in an operation in Indonesia when they pulled me out and sent me to Assam, to India. And then in Assam, I was assigned to the Detachment 101, and I took some jungle training there, you know, how to survive in the jungle. And just I was about to go and with to help the Kachin, they decided they needed me in China. So I flew over the hub, went to Kunming, and from Kunming, they took the train with south, the southernmost part of China, in still in Assam, I think. And then I mingled with the French, trying to find out what they were up to, and learning as much as we could about what had happened in that area. And there was the plan was that since we were contemplating fighting the Japanese in Indochina, maybe it would be a good idea to have some people who knew the area. So it was initially planned to train some of the French troops that had escaped from Indochina and returning back there under our control. Of course, I don't think the French took this very lightly, very nicely, because the French like to be in control, you know.
Sure.
And so, but I had a very interesting position is I was always with the French over there, and because the French did not know really who I was, they suspected that I was somebody connected with the U.S., but they still considered me a Frenchman. See? So they revealed things to me that normally would not say to the other people. And that was my demise in that area, because I reported their plans, and when it got to our command, it was decided to drop the French in our consideration. And of course, since I was the one in between, it didn't take long to the French to find out who I was working for, and they decided they didn't like me anymore. So they threatened me and they warned me they were going to kill me someday.
Well,
so my association with the French ended abruptly, because I was part of a team then that was dropped behind the Japanese line and to train troops or people that had been assembled there by two well-known, well, we didn't know who they were really, because the name didn't mean too much to me, to the Ho Chi Minh and Jap.
Yeah, exactly, who became obviously very famous later. I want to interrupt just one thing and clarify for me, please.
Yeah.
You know better than I do. I've only read this in the history books. But as I understand it, the French who were in Indochina when the Japanese invaded were loyal to Vichy France.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, and in March 1945, the Japanese, I guess, turned on those French.
March 1945, things changed drastically for the French.
Right.
They became the enemy of the Japanese.
Right.
Because, you see, by then, De Gaulle had shifted. Vichy no longer existed.
Right.
So they put the French in a very awkward position.
Now, the French you were talking about that streamed across the border into southern China that you were dealing with.
The guy who managed to escape.
But they were loyal to Vichy still, do you think?
I would say probably.
What was their...
They were loyal to Pétain.
Why? What was...
You have to understand there's two things in France. There's Vichy is an entity. It's a government.
Right.
Pétain is an individual, a hero, Marshal Pétain.
Marshal Pétain, yes.
You know, even to the very end, the French were reluctant to do anything to him. And of course, in the colonies, he was their savior, see?
Right.
So, you know, it's hard to criticize the French for not liking the heroes.
No, I understand. But I'm trying to understand, when the French that you dealt with in southern China, when they found out that you were affiliated with the United States, what was the source of their resentment? Did they resent you for being a spy?
The source of their resentment is that initially I was responsible to supply them with a lot of stuff. And I was doing this hiding from the Chinese. The Chinese didn't want to do anything. You know, the Chinese didn't like us rearming or re-equipping the French at all, because they considered it a threat to China. See, so because everything was a threat to China in those days.
Sure.
The Japanese were there, and we were their prisoners. You know, we were prisoners in China. I could not move in China. We got it without getting a pass from the Tupan. The Tupan is the regional chief, you know. we had to get okay to move in, to go anywhere.
Interesting. Now, was that the nationalist government or was that a warlord?
Warlord, usually. The central government of China, I don't think, was very powerful. I think they were kind of weak.
Sure.
Probably Chiang Kai-shek was probably the most, the strongest guy. He had to knock heads, though, to assume control. And I was there in Kunming when they had a fight over here, and Chiang Kai-shek won. But there was quite a few bodies on the street. Because the local warlord wanted to take over, see.
I understand.
So the situation in China in that time was such a mix-up affair. Nobody knew exactly where it was. We certainly did not know who we were dealing with, I tell you. Because if they had known, they would have told me, or at least they would let us know that what the situation was. But nobody knew who Ho Chi Minh was. And when I found out who Ho Chi Minh was, I was really shocked because, you see, as a former Frenchman, a student of history, of French history, I knew who started the French Communist Party. And I was bitterly anti-communist when I was in France. I was the opposite of the left side of French politics.
Sure.
I was a croix de feu. I don't know if you know what a croix de feu were.
No, sir.
They were an extreme nationalist group, you know, that wanted to knock off the German out of their pedestal, wanted to, you know, as a kid, this is my feelings, you know. And the communists were putting France in a very awkward position. They were strike all the time. They were pitting one side of France against the other. It was terrible. So when I found out that the guy who had created the French Communist Party was the guy I was helping later on, you know, Ho Chi Minh, that was not his name. I didn't know him under that name. He says it was Nguyen Hai Quoc.
My goodness.
And here we were, helping the guy, you know. And I don't, and then I want to tell you something. The guy in charge of my team, I had no idea who it was. And I don't think anybody in OSS knew anything about the guy.
Well, let me ask you this. You're in southern China talking to French refugees, and then you get moved from there into what is now...
Let me tell you what the sequence of events. Once they decided to drop the French entirely, they decided to help another group. And this is when the head of my team went ahead and dropped behind the line with an interpreter, a radio operator, and when they communicated when they contacted the group that we were supposed to help, the first thing they said, we don't want any French over here. That was the first reaction of it, because we were still thinking of bringing some of the French people who knew the area better than we did. So it was out. But they say, Rene, we have to find lines of retreat from there. So you're going to take a bunch of Indo-Chinese and dress in U.S. uniform and cross the border and make sure that we know how to get out of the place when the time comes. So with me, they finally used their head. They gave a French officer, a captain, to work with me. The day I was leaving early in the morning, I got a message on my radio. It said, get back to our base, to Posse, and don't go anywhere. So when I get to Posse, they say, oh, Rene, thank you for returning. You're jumping tomorrow afternoon and join Thomas, who was ahead of me, see. I said, what about the rest? Oh, forget the other guys. You go, you know. And the guy said to me, now, with a name like De Forno, you know, it's too French. You better use another name because they don't like the French people where you're going. So I said, pick up a name. I said, okay. I thought for a moment. I said, Douglas. Raymond Douglas. Okay, remember, Rene, from now on, you're Raymond Douglas. And tell you guys that you're no longer De Forno, okay? Yes, sir. Got aboard, we dropped behind, and the first guy that I met after, I was the last guy to jump, by the way, Only two of us had jumped ever before. All the guys who went with me, they never jumped out of an airplane before.
Well, what kind of airplane? Was it a C-47?
C-47. Oh, a good airplane. The airplane was okay.
Yeah, and what? How big was your team that was jumping in?
We had two teams. I had four of my team, three of the other team, so seven. There were seven of us.
And let me ask, were you required to wear uniforms at that time, or did you wear civilian clothes?
Yeah, what uniform? Yeah, we were, well, the uniform we were wearing was just plain GI stuff, you know, fatigues. That's all we wore in fatigue.
Right.
No ranks showing. We never showed the ranks or anything.
And how about when, thinking back when you met with the French in China and you didn't want to show you?
I didn't know exactly who I was, you see.
Did you wear an American uniform, or did you just...
No, I was wearing, khaki. But everybody has khaki over there.
Right.
You couldn't tell the difference between an American and someone else from another country, because we didn't wear any ranks, you see.
Right. Very interesting. And do you remember what kind of weapon you personally carried when you...
What was that?
What kind of weapons you were issued when you went into Vietnam?
Oh, heck, when I was in Vietnam, what did I... I think I had a carbine.
Okay.
A very, very... The basic carbine of
sure.
the U.S. Army.
M1 carbine?
Yeah, M1 carbine. You couldn't even hit the door of a barn. this thing was worthless, except if you were 10 feet from the guy, then you could shoot him, you know, and kill him. Maybe kill him. But we were not concerned too much with weapons because we had everything. We had mortar, we had bazooka, name it, we have it, you know. We had all kinds of weapons with us when we did drop with us, you know.
So where was your headquarters in North Indochina? Where
you
did
know, you? It was, you mean in Indochina?
Right, when you landed,
it
where
was
did...
northeast of Thanh Nguyen.
Okay.
We dropped, our headquarters was a little town named, I think, was Chochu, C-H-O-C-H-U.
Okay.
That was the name of the place, Chochu. The first guy that I met was this guy. I was the last one jumping. I had to push one guy. He froze at the door. I pushed him. He made a turn. He went around again. And the last time, I was the last one to jump. And when I landed, I was lucky enough. We landed in Rice Paddy to drop right on a beautiful dry spot. See, and when I was folding my parachute, when all of a sudden appeared this guy wearing a white suit, black tie, black Homburg, and wearing and holding a black umbrella, although it wasn't raining, and he approached me and bid me welcome to wherever he was, and he said, my boss or whoever in charge is not here, he's on the doing something, and I will take you to the village where we have a house for you, or a house, or a hut for you, you know, because we didn't have any houses over there, there was shacks.
So this man is dressed like he is downtown London.
What was that?
This man is greeting you, is dressed like he is downtown London.
I thought he came out of a bank meeting, you know. I didn't realize. In the middle of the jungle, can you imagine? The thing is, a rice paddy, jungle, tall trees, everything. And here's this guy greeting me there. I said, my God, what the heck is this guy? Well, I didn't know who he was. And he called himself Mr. Van.
Mr. Van.
I'm Mr. Van, and our leader is very sick in the village, but now I'm going to take you where you're going to spend the night. And by golly, they had beer for us.
Beer?
Beer. Yeah, I don't know where they got that beer. It was terrible, but that was bad anyway. So we drank the beer, and all the guys who never jumped were heroes then because they finally made a jump and blah blah blah. So the next morning, the other team left, and we didn't know what happened to these guys because after they were gone for about a day, we realized the maps they were supposed to use to tell them where to go, had never been taken. We still had them. So they were without any instructions whatsoever. So they left. Meanwhile, we start getting the team together. Mr. Van, which was Mr. Jopp, was putting a group of about 150 guys, and we start, he took us to the place where those guys were assembled, and it turned out that was like a school. It turned out to be an indoctrinating school in the arts of communist interference in the country.
Oh, my goodness.
The combo, you know, the political commissar was running school there, and we came in and started teaching them how to use weapons. Well, the guy I was working with, the guy in charge of our team, Major Thomas, knowing that he would have to train some soldiers over there, brought bags full of field manual, U.S. Army field manual.
Okay.
And I had been in France with the guerrilla, you know, with the resistance, see? And I know that what you need is not field manual. But I didn't say anything. And we start teaching these guys conventional warfare operations. We even went as far as doing triangulation. Are you familiar with triangulation?
Yes,
you know,
sir.
To learn how to aim your rifle in the right direction, so on.
Right.
And we're doing this, you know, triangulation.
And just to be clear for the transcript, Mr. Van was Jap, who turned out to be Jap. General
we
Jap.
Know. We didn't know who he was. We learned later on that it was Guenbo Jap. Yeah, he was General Jap, a school teacher who had joined this team there and was more or less the second in command of this operation.
And let me ask you, personality-wise, we'll talk about Ho Chi Minh, but how did you find General Jap to deal with on your level at that time?
General Jap, my own impression is that I don't think that Ho Chi Minh and Jap were on the same
wavelength.
I think there was a difference between them. I could never figure out the real difference, but I know that Jap was doing things independently than Ho. Because I spotted one day, one guy came in, we were together over there for something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I saw this guy approaching Chop and slip into him some piece of paper. You know. And then Chop didn't do anything. He kept it in his hand. Then pretty soon I noticed that he was opening that piece of paper and reading what was in it. Ho Chi Minh was lying next to him. He was sitting next to Ho Chi Minh. Never turned around. Never told Ho Chi Minh anything. And he kept unrolling his thing. He read what it was, and he stuffed it in his mouth and chew on it.
Oh!
Swallow it.
Interesting.
Now, that to me wasn't strange. You know, I said, gee whiz, what's the matter with this guy? He gets something, he doesn't tell or anything to his boy. He didn't have to speak very loud. He could have said something. He could have, you know, but no. I know he was doing this to make sure that Ho Chi Minh did not see him.
That's very interesting. And how did Jap deal with you and the other Americans? Was there a general friendship, or was it mistrust? Was he wary?
He was kind of aloof. He was not as friendly and outgoing as Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh, of course, was outgoing. He was trying to figure out who the hell I was, see?
Right. of course.
That was his main concern. He said, who the hell does this guy speak French so well? Nobody speaks French in his team. If he does, how come? You know, and of course I had a cover story telling him. I was raised in a bilingual family. My mother was French. My father was American. So we spoke both languages, you know, blah, 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 you know. But I don't think he believed me. But I know what he was doing. He was trying to figure out, who the heck is this guy? Douglas. And, of course, there was no record of it anywhere.
My goodness.
He had a spy. I know he had spies among the French. He had spies. So when he asked the French if they knew anybody named Douglas, they'd probably say, who?
So you think among the French themselves, they were collaborators and people sympathetic to the Viet Minh and to Ho Chi Minh?
I don't think so. I don't think there were many French collaborating with anybody.
Okay.
Let me tell you about the condition, the situation of the French, and now and the situation of OSS. You see what happened when we decided to operate over there. We had no assets at all, except there was a group of three guys, GBT. Have you ever heard of GBT? Gordon, blah, blah, and Tan. Those three guys who were part of an engineering group that were operating in Southeast Asia, who were engineers, they were not spies, but they were sharp and they collected a lot of information and they put the information for sale. And the British bought some of the information, the Chinese bought some of it, and then when we came, they came to the OSS selling their stuff. OSS say, hey, wait a minute, we don't buy stuff like this. You better work for us. And they say, uh-huh, we're not going to work for you. We don't want to work for anybody. We are independent. So their sources in Indochina were French sources.
And they were Americans, these people.
Yeah. No. These guys were not Americans. One was a Chinese. Ten was the only American. Frankie Tan was an American.
Okay.
Of Chinese descent. He might have been born in China. I don't know. He's dead now. He died. But the other two were French.
Oh, I see.
You know, so these guys were collecting information. They had an operation going on, and the information they collected, they sold it to the highest bidder or to anybody who wanted to buy it. That was their, apparently, their livelihood.
My goodness.
This is crazy. So the OSS decided this is no good. We can't trust this kind of information. We got to go to the bottom of this. So they gave a job to a guy named Charlie Fenn to get close to these guys and see what they were up to. So Charlie Fenn didn't get very far with them. They didn't want him, you know, they wanted to be independent.
And these three men were in China?
Yeah.
Okay.
These guys were in China. They were crossing the border back and forth. They knew the area quite well, you know, having worked there for years. They knew the area. They knew better than we did, you know. So they. But anyway, so this is when Charlie Fenn learned about the existence. Oh, after the 12th of March, you know, we were out of luck because not only JBT could not get information because they were no longer there, and the French who were helping them either were in concentration camp or they were dead or they tried to escape.
Right.
Some of them went to China. So our operation, all of a sudden, the information we were getting just dried up completely. So up to the time, we were not allowed to use natives because the natives were far too close to Japan, because Japan promised these people their freedom.
Independence, yeah.
Independence. Oh, yeah. This is the first thing they did, you know, the Japanese. And they went behind the French and organized resistance group against the French.
Right.
The Japanese had resistance group against the French and, of course, against anybody who wanted to take over. So this is what happened. So How did we manage to get hold of Ho Chi Minh? One thing very few people knew, and I didn't know it at the time, is that Ho Chi Minh was an agent of the Chinese. He was a Chinese agent. First, he was captured by one of the warlords and locked up for 18 months. I think near Chongqing somewhere in China.
Okay.
And it came up like the Chinese made a deal, arguing among themselves that what we need really is a pro-Chinese movement in Southeast Asia, in Indochina. So who the heck do we have? So somebody had a bright idea to get Ho Chi Minh out of jail and make a deal with him. Of course, he didn't refuse the deal. That was the best deal anybody could make. They made a deal with him. They said, you go back over there, start a pro-Chinese movement, and you're free. So he did. Except the pro-Chinese movement to turn out to be a pro-Ho Chi Minh movement.
Right.
And that was called the Viet Minh thing.
Right.
And that was how Ho Chi Minh. So this came to the attention of GBT, those three guys. And then pretty soon it came to the attention of Charlie Fenn. Well, they didn't know how to where Ho Chi Minh was, because he was going back and forth between Indochina and China. And one day, on his return back to China, Ho Chi Minh was given a pilot who had been shot down, who had escaped, and he was asked by some of the local people, by the people in charge of the escape and evasion, if he would mind taking this guy back to Kunming, to the 14th Air Force. And he said, of course not. I'll be glad to do it.
Okay.
That is when Ho Chi Minh became known.
And that's when he came up on your scope.
Yeah. Then Charlie Fenn was told to go meet the guy and hire him and so on and so forth. The story is a fascinating story.
It certainly is.
And then what happened? Charlie Fenn contacted Ho Chi Minh and asked, and Ho Chi Minh said, sure, I'd be glad to help you. He was working at the time for the Chinese, but we didn't know it. We had no idea that he was working for the Chinese.
But,
I'm telling you.
The Americans were the only ones who did anything to help him, right? The Chinese didn't send advisors in or equipment to help
him. No. They didn't give him... No. They used him because he could go back and forth.
Right.
He didn't... What his mission was to start a pro-Chinese movement. Well, you don't need a radio to start a pro-Chinese movement. You need a recruiting method. You need somebody to get these guys going. You get, maybe they give him money. I don't know if he had any money or not. They probably give him some money to pay some people to organize these groups. You see? But that was before we got there.
Right.
Then when we got there, these guys were already organized, and he had picked up his the group he was going to use, and so on and so forth. And Jop was the guy who was in charge of the instructions thing. So when we hired Ho Chi Minh and sent him back, then we made a deal, asking him if he wouldn't mind having somebody trainees from a military point of view, not from a political. See, he was training these guys from a
That's very interesting.
Sure.
Now, in your operation, when you were there in Chochi, how many Americans were there at one time?
We were, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
So 7 of you made up the training team?
Yeah, yeah. I was more or less in charge of the training. Thomas was floating around looking, trying to, it was a relationship, guys. He dealt more with the local people, a lot more than I did. I didn't fool around. I stayed with the troops, and my main concern was to train these guys on how to use the weapon we were giving them, see.
And all business was conducted in French?
Well, I had to do in French.
No, I mean for the other Americans as well.
Yeah, some of those guys didn't speak French either, so we had an interpreter from French, a Vietnamese interpreter, the guy who translated from French into Vietnamese.
I see.
But most of those guys were pretty sharp, I tell you. They were. I don't think their education was so extensive, but they were very intelligent. I tell you, Ho Chi Minh knew how to pick up his people.
Right. And was there any threat day-to-day from the Japanese? Was there any chance of patrols or aircraft or any threat to you?
No, we were pretty well isolated where we were. I don't think the Japanese would like to come where we were because it was not a very friendly location anyway.
Sure.
And there were some Japanese camps there, not too far from where we were. But the Japanese didn't move too much. They stay in what the French had constructed, forts. You know, forts made out of hard stone bricks,
Sure.
And they made these things all around the place, and that's where the Japanese used to stay. They didn't venture too much outside. The only Japanese I did see myself is when the war was over. Then they were all over the place.
Right. So Tell me about Ho Chi Minh. I mean, if Jap was standoffish or aloof, how was Ho Chi Minh dealing with the Americans?
Oh, he was a very friendly. He spoke English, of course. And,
he did?
He was very, very gregarious. And, well, he was not very gregarious when I first met him. He was sick as a dog. He had the medic. We had a medic with us, a full-fledged nurse we had with us. And when a nurse, when he checked him, he came back to me and said, boy, this guy doesn't have long for this world. He said, well, he's got everything. And plus thing, I don't even know what it is, he said, but he's really ill.
Tropical diseases, you think?
He had dysentery. He had, I think, dengue fever. He had malaria. He had probably hepatitis. He was yellow as a, you know. So to really know exactly what it was, we didn't have the tools to do it, no, the means, but we had enough stuff with us, so we gave him some of the medicine we had with us. I don't know if it helped or anything. The only thing we had, we didn't even have quinine, which is almost a must over there. We had no quinine.
For malaria?
Yeah, we had atabrine, which is a preventive, not a cure. It's a preventive, not a cure. So we had nothing really to. Well, so in about 2 or 3 days after I saw him half dead, I would say maybe a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks, he walks in. I couldn't believe the guy would recover that soon, you know. But I found out that he had sent his boys in the jungle to pick up all kinds of stuff, herbs and plants, and he made a brew. And he told me that's what saved him. It's not our medicine. It's just, he knew what the plant are good for him, you know. That was his.
Do you think our medicine helped him, though?
Huh?
Do you think our medicine helped him, or at least saved?
I don't know. Yeah. I could, you know, what we had, I don't think it helped. We all had something. After we got back, we all got sick. All my team got dysentery. I didn't get dysentery. I was the only one who didn't get dysentery. But I got worse. I got the malaria. I got pernicious malaria. And what else did I get? Oh, I was sick as oh, and I got hepatitis. Oof.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so Ho Chi Minh, talking to him was nice. He talked to me very freely. He was, you know, we had good conversation because he knew that I knew history and so on. So he, and he very very nicely said. Okay, he said, Mr. De Forno, how come you speak so well French? And I mean, Mr. Douglas. Mr. Douglas, how come you speak so good French and the other you French don't? I said, oh, Mr. Ho, I was raised in a bilingual family. Where's your mother coming from? Where's your dad coming from? He was asking me all kinds of questions. See?
And he never figured out that you were French?
No. I don't know. Oh, later he found out who I was.
Yeah.
Because the French, the first thing the French did is told him.
Oh, my goodness. Before we get to that, though, he spoke fluent English, Ho Chi Minh?
Very good English, yeah.
And where did he learn English? What do you think?
He traveled. Ho Chi Minh traveled all over Europe, and he was in America for a while. He was a cook in America in some restaurant over in New York.
How bizarre.
And he's a man who could lick, I don't know how many languages he spoke, but he spoke fluent Chinese. All his, you know, he was more Chinese than Vietnamese because his poetry, and he was a poet, by the way, was always in Chinese.
I did not know that.
It was never in French or never in Vietnamese. It was in Chinese.
And looking back on it, at the time, did he seem like he was genuinely pro-American, or was he the Americans only ones who can help me, so I'll be nice to them? What was your impression?
I don't think he was pro or against anything. What he was is an admirer of the U.S. who he believed, and this is what he told me many times, that we would handle his country the way we handled the Philippines. He kept mentioning to me, you did a wonderful job in the Philippines. Lord, the Philippines is now a free country, blah. I think we deserve the same treatment from
right.
The French that you did. You got to help us reach this point where we will be independent. He said, after all, we are self-sufficient. We can handle ourselves. We are very smart, blah, blah, blah. We don't need the French to do anything for us. We can do it ourselves. And you guys know that, and you did it in the Philippines, and you got to help us.
Oh, it's very interesting.
What are you going to say to that?
Right.
He says, I'm sorry, we don't like the Philippines. Oh, yeah, the Philippines. But that was his idea, was we would help him acquire the same status as the Philippines acquired. You know, no longer a colony, but an independent country.
Right. Now, VJ Day comes in August 1945.
Yeah.
Where are you at that time?
I was in the middle of the jungle. I didn't even know that the war was ending. Thomas knew, our boss did, and we got a rumor through someone there who said the war, I think the war is over. But Thomas knew, but he never told us that the war was over.
Why wouldn't he tell you?
I have no idea. I never could figure that guy out. Anyway, the war was over. Oh, by the way, after the war, I lost my job as second in command, and Mr. Jap took over from me. Because Thomas, the boss, started doing things with Jap, and ignoring us completely. Because, you see, I never understood Thomas' position. I don't think he knew exactly who he was dealing with. I really don't think he did.
Well, let's talk about him for a minute. What rank was he? Who was he?
He was a major.
He was a major.
Yeah.
And he was the team leader of the seven of you?
I don't know much about him, except I know in civilian life he was an attorney, and he was proud of the fact that his first 12 cases, he lost them.
Oh, that's something to be proud of.
This is what it is. And he shot himself accidentally.
And he was in charge.
And he was in charge. Well, I don't know. He doesn't know how close he came from getting frogged by the enlisted man. I spent more time quieting down and saying, come on, you guys, you can't do that. No, forget it, you know.
This is among the seven of you in the jungle?
Yeah. Oh, wow. You know, he would send us ahead. He sent me and the guys ahead. Then he would show up maybe 5-6 hours later. And I could figure out, why was he doing this? And one day we decided to wait. We waited in the trail, and all of a sudden, there's a horse coming. And who was on top of the horse? Thomas. And who was trotting behind somebody carrying his bag, his sack? This guy was using a horse.
Very strange.
And he made us walk.
Very strange.
I'm telling you, the Captain Holland and I, we had a heck of a job to keep the enlisted men from revolting, you know.
So,
well, let me tell you something else, the way it is.
Please.
No, I was the second in command, and we were in a room about 2x4, you know, not, I mean 10x20 feet, you know. We're in a room all together. And he said, we have to have a meeting. He said, we have to meet. Lieutenant, I want you to tell the men, tomorrow morning, we're going to get up at such time, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. First, I thought he was joking. So I turned around. You heard the major say, guys? Okay. He kept doing this, and I couldn't understand why. Why did he have to address me and me telling the guy when everybody was there, you know? So one day I say, okay, Sergeant, I want you to tell. And he went down the line, and the last guy, the lonely PFC we had, says, who the heck do you want me to tell to? I'm telling you, this was a big farce as far as I was concerned. When he came up with a triangulation and had these guys aim the rifle against a piece of paper and having the guy... the target moved, so the guy and with a pencil made a mark, and the guy who had the smallest triangle, he had a prize for him. Guess what the prize?
What was
it? A pack of cigarettes. None of these kids, and we were a bunch of kids, they were kids, you know, smoked. They gave these guys a pack of cigarettes. Didn't even know what the cigarette was. This guy only smoked bamboo, you know.
Yeah.
Bamboo tube.
My goodness. So VJ Day comes, you don't even know the war is over, you're
no,
in the jungle.
Finally he came up and said, yeah, the war is over. Oh, by the way, our radio operator make sure that we were isolated. He was in full control of the radio. And when when he didn't want to operate the radio, the radio didn't work, period. Boom.
And your instructions were you communicated to Kunming?
Yeah, we had two communicating to Kunming or Posei, either one. But we could communicate with both areas.
Where was the second area?
Posei, which was the base where we started from.
Yeah, but is that in southern China?
Posei was an air base.
In southern China?
In southern China.
Okay. So what happens when you find out the war is over? Do you immediately pull out?
We reestablish contact with Kunming, and the first instruction they give us, pick up all your stuff, don't give anything to anybody, find a place to land a plane, and we'll come pick you up. That was easier said than done, because where we were, there was no place to land, believe me. So we had to go to a larger city. And when we got there, we couldn't find a place to land either, to bring a plane. The closest place we could have bring a plane was Hanoi. So we had to go to Hanoi. And they told us, go to Hanoi alone. Do not go with Ho Chi Minh, or with Jop, and everything. Just take a guide, one guide, and travel on your own to Hanoi. Of course, you know, and then... Don't give anything to anybody, blah, 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 blah. The first thing Thomas does is give our stuff, personal stuff, to the Viet Minh, to Jop and the rest of them. Radio, and not radio, but the binoculars we had, all the stuff that we need, and the weapons we had, give everything to those guys. So when we finally got to Hanoi, we were stripped practically with everything. We had nothing, except he had given everything away. So
when you left that camp, that was the last time you saw Ho Chi Minh and Jap?
Oh, no. Ho Chi Minh had left before us.
Okay.
He was ahead of us.
Okay.
And when we got to Hanoi, we went to, he had established his headquarters, and he greeted us. He said, welcome. Oh, he had become the head, the de facto head of state, you know. He was the big boss. Ho Chi Minh was assumed the job of president of the country, the new country, so without any, because there was no election, there was nothing, but he was the only guy who was really strong enough to hold things together. So, and then when we arrived, he showed us where his office was, and he says, "I want you to meet someone very important." And we were waiting, and this silly fellow came in, pudgy face, and he said, "Please meet my emperor, His Excellency Mao Dai." That was emperor of Amman, you know.
Yes,
of course he had resigned his position.
He was a Japanese puppet.
Yeah. So he introduced him to us. And when the guy shook my hand, it was like holding a wet fish. He had no strength in that hand. And I tell you, I said to myself, what kind of a guy is this, you know? Ho Chi Minh gave you a very, he was tough, you know. When he shook your hand, you knew he shook your hand. Oh, Mao Dai, he had no strength anywhere. It was a big pile of blob, you know.
He was just a playboy.
Yeah, you know, he had his girlfriend on the Riviera. I guess he went back there. He says, well, the heck, this job. Emperor is not very good. I better get out of there.
So you're in Hanoi meeting Bao Dai, Emperor Bao Dai, and Ho Chi Minh at the same time in the same. Wow.
Can you imagine? I bet to be introduced to Bao Dai by Ho Chi Minh. This takes the cake, you know.
And did Ho Chi Minh show any hostility toward Bao Dai?
No, he said, meet my emperor.
Yeah. Bizarre.
He introduced him.
Bizarre.
Emperor.
So okay, so you're in Hanoi with Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah, and then he gave us a place to stay, and he took care of us for about, I would say, maybe a couple of weeks that we were. No, not even that long. Maybe a week and a half we were there, and I began to be very sick. I didn't feel good at all. I felt miserable. I think, and I didn't know what was wrong with me, so when I went back to Kunming, I flew back to Kunming on aboard one of the C-47, and when I got back in Kunming, the doctor said, I don't know what you have, you better go home. So I got on the plane to, and flew to, first to Calcutta. In Calcutta, we had a layover there, and I was feeling so bad that I was having a supper with a bunch of nurses, and they say, tomorrow morning, you better go on sick call. So I went on sick call, and boy, the doctor, we just came to the United States, a young doctor, knew exactly what I had. I had hepatitis. And boy, I spent 3 months in a hospital in Calcutta.
In Calcutta, under British care?
Yeah, during the British Revolution. Oh, they were fighting all around the hospital.
Really?
They were fighting. They were, oh my God, it was a mess. Calcutta was a real mess. It's a mess anyway, but
right.
That was a real mess this time.
I read in a history book once that Ho Chi Minh, at the end of the war, gave an address in Hanoi, and he quoted from the U.S. Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, we gave it to him.
Right.
He got the declaration from us.
On either side of him were OSS officers standing on the podium.
Yeah, that was Paddy and Gurney, what is his name? There were the only two guys there. I wasn't there.
You were gone by then.
Yeah, because Captain Paddy flew directly from Kunming to Hanoi. Yeah. Have you ever seen this movie called Uncle Ho and Uncle Sam?
No, I haven't.
It was made by the BBC. If you promise to return it, I'll send it to you.
Oh, I would love to, and of course I promise.
That is really revealing. I don't agree with everything that is said there, but you will meet the personality that I mentioned to you, like Frankie Tan. You're going to meet Charlie Fenn, who's both of them are dead now. And you will see one guy named Douglas, you know, Raymond Douglas. He's on it, too.
Are you interviewed on there?
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting. Let me ask you, though, why did they fly to Hanoi to stand with Ho Chi Minh and let him declare independence by using our was it by design, or were these officers freelancing?
Oh, what was it? I didn't follow you. What was that?
I'm sorry. When they flew to Hanoi from Kunming to be with Ho Chi Minh when he declared independence and he was in Hanoi,
yeah,
was that part of a design? Were they following orders, or were these officers freelancing and they shouldn't have been there? I mean, what can...
No. What happened is that they were sent over there because we had some prisoners over here. Primarily, the main purpose of the U.S. forces there was to get our prisoners, you know, pilots and so on, that
sure.
locked up, to get them out of there.
Sure.
And of course, since we've been doing business with Ho Chi Minh, they sent a guy named Grilecki. Grilecki's job was to contact Ho Chi Minh. Except, you see, he was never briefed. He didn't even know who Ho Chi Minh was. This is crazy, I'll tell you. Paddy was over there to pick up the teams, guys, like our team, and bring him back. That was the main purpose, because we had nobody there, so we had to have a representative of OSS on the ground to pick up these guys. We had to report to him, you know, we reported to him, and so on and so forth. That was it, see. Why did he even contact Ho Chi Minh? I have no idea. I have no idea what transpired from Kunming and Hanoi. I have no idea. All I know is that we were told to get out of there as fast as we could. Now, the problem, I'm going to explain the problem with it, is that the French wanted to return to reestablish their position in their colony.
Of course.
And they were waiting in Kunming, and the U.S. did not want to give them a plane to get. So they were stuck until we say, okay, you now you can go. By that time, Ho Chi Minh had declared his independence, blah, 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 and the French weren't there.
Now, why, let me ask you this.
We deliberately held them so they wouldn't go there before Ho Chi Minh had a chance, or may they make a declaration.
So that was deliberately done.
I'm not sure. I'm sure after you see the movie I'm going to send you, you will say, oh, the son of a gun. Of course they did. Of course they kept this guy. They didn't want him to come back to Hanoi. My God, no. That would have been stupid.
Right.
So we kept him there.
So you never went back to Indochina until you went back in 1957?
Yeah, I was invited many times. Ho Chi Minh wanted to come back, invited us, and blah, blah, blah. Thomas went back many times.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, I think he went back during the war.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't have to tell you that Thomas, he thought that Giap and Ho Chi Minh were agrarian reformers. You hear me?
Yeah.
Agrarian reformers. Do you know what these are?
Yeah, of course.
Well, Ho Chi Minh didn't even know what hand of the shovel you hold. Giap never knew how the milk came out of a cow.
Right. There,
I can give you an example of how these guys were. They were political character who tried to take all control of their country. They were not agrarian reformer because if they had been, you're not going to tell me that a great country like Indochina, which was a supplier, you understand, of rice to the rest of Asia, became an importer of rice when they came, because they ruined the economy of that country, which was an exporting country, and that was it.
Right.
You know. So when you're an agrarian reformer, at least you would have the you be succeeding at something, but they didn't. They failed in everything.
If you have more time in about 3 minutes, I have to change the tape because I'm running out of time on one tape. But when we come back, I'd like to ask you about your dealings with the French. You said a couple of times that the French had figured out who you were, went to Ho Chi Minh and told him. In an effort to discredit you, to hurt you?
After the war.
Because the
French knew who I was, you know. So when they dealt, you know, the French were dealing with Ho Chi Minh for several years, you know, and the French even returned.
Right.
They returned their army, they returned their political and everything. But Ho Chi Minh was, I think the first thing maybe he said that, what about this guy, Douglas, and the French say, what do you mean, Douglas? Douglas is a fiction. Because the French very quickly found out who I was. See, what I didn't tell you is that once the French realized what I was doing, that I was not exactly on their side, they cornered me one day and threatened to kill me. Right then.
And who were these? French settlers? French military officers?
They were military officers. All of them were officers.
And they were all
colonel, major, up to colonel. Colonel, major, captain.
And they saw this because you were a traitor in their eyes?
Yeah, and because they warned me. They said, we're going to kill you. That was before I even went to Ho Chi Minh. You know, they didn't even know I was going to be there.
Right.
But because I was, I gave them the instruction that I received from Kunming to return everything that I had given them, they held me responsible for some reason. They say, yeah, you know, you're a traitor, you blah, blah, blah. So I didn't know what to say, and the guy said, the guy who saved my neck, his name was a French officer named McCarthy.
McCarthy.
McCarthy. He was a French officer. He said, Defono, we're not going to kill you now, but watch your back. We're going to get you one of these days. We're gonna get you. And they tried.
And that's
tried
called
twice.
And that's called saving you, huh?
Yeah, they tried twice to do away with me, but each time I was warned ahead of time.
How did they try to do away with you?
Well, they were preparing a party, a lynching party for me. When I went back to Kunming, I was about to go to town. And, of course, you can be murdered in the middle of Kunming. Nobody will know the difference. Fortunately for me, a friend of mine named Lou Kunin, who was a captain in OSS.
Oh, he became famous later because he became chief of station in Saigon.
Lou saved my neck because Lou had good contact. They didn't even know who Lou was either. Because Lou was very close to the French. He had been in the French Foreign Legion, and I think he plays card very well. And
yeah, his name is Lou.
The French one told him, "Where's the foreigner? Where's the foreigner? We want him." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well," and then they say, "We're gonna invite him to a party." Well, he knew what kind of party it was gonna be. You know? So he says, "Rene, you better not leave the post. You better stay at the compound tonight." Then I took his warning seriously.
Sure.
I know the French were not fooling around because I know what I've done in the past, the guys who crossed their path. Then we go to Calcutta. In Calcutta, I go to the Great Western, and who is sitting there with three French officers? All Lou Cooney. "Hey, Lou, how are you? Rene, come in." He said, "Gentlemen, Rene, I want you to meet Captain Thayer, Lieutenant Thayer, blah, 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 you know. And gentlemen, this is Lieutenant Rene DeForno." The three stood up and walked out.
They didn't
even say boo. They stood up, they left the drink on the table and walked out. Then I had a feeling that I was not very welcome with this group. So I move away, Lou rejoined him, and then he come back and say, "You better get back to the hotel right now and don't leave. Don't go anywhere tonight. You understand?"
My goodness.
So, and then they try once more. But they didn't do it. You know? It took me 4 years before I went back to France, you know.
Because of those hard feelings?
Well, they my own office, my CIC, told me to not to go back to France. You know? Because they knew the threat was a serious threat. They knew that was going to do it to me.
And what did that stem from? Were they anti you because they thought of you as a traitor, or they didn't like the United States?
Yeah, I never understood that my allegiance was no longer for France, my allegiance for the United States. After all, I was a citizen of the United States. I wasn't a citizen of France. I was being paid by the U.S. to do a job, and I took my job seriously. These guys thought that I was supposed to do their bidding. You know, I didn't want to do that.
Right.
I didn't do them by the French.
Right.
And, of course, when they found out that I had helped Ho Chi Minh, oh, my God.
Well, you're really unwelcome.
That was the end. This guy's got to go, you know. But all those guys who threatened me, they're dead now.
Yeah, they're gone.
And I'm still there.
So, hold on one second. I need to change the tape. So,
what am I? I have to put on the light. I'm in the dark right now.
So, the whole part of the first part of the Indochina War between...
Don't forget to give me your address.
Oh, of course I will. I'll send it to you in an email.
Okay, send me the address. And I will send you the tape, but return it. Huh?
I promise you. I'll watch it and I'll give it right back.
Because, you know, I made about 25 of those tapes, and some people don't return them. And
that's not nice. And it's
expensive.
It's called Uncle Ho and Uncle Sam?
Yeah, Uncle Ho and Uncle Sam.
Okay.
It was made by the BBC, and you will see how the BBC play their cards, and they always try to put a dig against the U.S.
Of course, that's the British way.
They're very good at it. You know.
Of course.
But you look at it, and you tell me how they play that thing. I thought you heard me. See what happened.
Absolutely. No, it's going to be very interesting. I appreciate that. So the whole of the Indochina War from 1946 to 1954, you have nothing to do with.
I had nothing to do with it, except from 1957, Dien Bien Phu happened in 54. Well, I was assigned in Laos, And my job was to run operations against North Vietnam from Laos. You understand?
Okay.
Okay. The French, of course, they knew who I was. They tried every trick in the books to get me out of there.
Wait, what? I'm confused though. When you were there, and
I was working for CIA then.
Right. Well, why would the French try? The French are finished by then. They lost the war. 55.
The
they leave.
The French are never finished with you. When they start with you, they keep after you. You know, until something, either they're dead or you dead.
But 1950 for the transcripts, 1954 Dien Bien Phu happens. The French lose.
Yeah, well, I wasn't there, but we were. You know, Laos was divided. The function of helping Laos was divided by into two after Seattle. You know, Southeast Asia Treaty. Blah blah blah.
Right.
The U.S. was responsible for the helping Laos government, especially their military, they were financing the military, and the French were responsible for the training. Of course, we train them for guerrilla warfare, no, for conventional warfare, and the French we supply them with material for conventional warfare, and the French were teaching them guerrilla warfare. So we never got on, we never were on the same wavelength, you see.
Right.
And I was there, that's a big story, but I was there with CIA and the Pentagon and all this, and I was trying to do something, and the French had to get out. When they get out of North Vietnam, they had some assets over there, very interesting assets. The French had good intelligence over there. So when they had to leave, the asset would have gone to nothing. So one guy who was decided to give it to me, give me his principal agent and a couple of nets, I guess, and I started handling them for him. And of course, the French didn't like this because the French I was dealing with was military. The French intelligence people were independent of the French military, and they didn't like me getting too friendly with the French military. So they would go to my boss and say, you know what, the Fourneau told us, oh, blah, blah, and they gave him, and my boss would say, how dare you do this like this? How dare you tell these people? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, because what you just told me, not only I don't know it, never heard of it, this is the first time, how could I tell somebody that I don't know?
Was this taking place in Vientiane, the capital?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it was, then it took him a while to realize, I said, that the French were singing for my benefit. You know?
Right.
and this jerk finally realized what the French were doing. Then he lay off. He said, okay, forget him, you know. But they tried like the Dickens to get me out of there. So finally, I think what the French did to get me out of there, they bribed a witch doctor to give me a lulu of a disease. And the first time it happened, I spent, I think, a couple of months in Bangkok in a hospital. Boy, I was a sick dog. I had a case of furunculosis. You know what this is?
I've never heard of that.
Furunculosis and boils.
Oh.
I had boils. I had 29 boils between my navel and knees.
Ouch.
And they were, each one was just a most painful thing. So I was in isolation in the hospital for a couple of months. Then I went back to Vientiane, and all in behold, I got hit again with the same down thing. And then finally the boss said, Renee, I think you better go back. So I went back to the United States, but returned to Okinawa in Japan and ran my operation from there, see.
Where in Japan were you, where did you live?
I live at Grand Heights.
Grand Heights, of course, it's a housing area.
Huh?
It's a housing area.
Yeah, it's a housing area.
See, I was born in Okinawa, and I lived in...
Oh, where?
Lived at Naha Air Base, which is not there anymore.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, I spent 3 years in Okinawa.
Okay.
And ran the operation from Okinawa.
When were you there?
I was there from, 68 to 63. No, 58 to 59. 60, and in Japan from 60 to 63.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a good time in Okinawa. Of course, you know, I could tell you some stupid thing that the military does. I tell you, I'm always amazed how we survive, how we win wars. We win wars because we're very lucky, not because we're smart.
When did you go back to France finally for another visit?
I came back to France in 1986.
You had not been back to France before then?
No, I never returned to France for that. By that time, all the guys who had threatened me had died. and so I felt pretty safe that they didn't bother me. And the guy would take over from them. They didn't care one way or the other, you know. They shouldn't care less.
And so, who were these? I mean, you told me once they're military officers, but were they colonists who grew up in Indochina and lived there all their lives, or did they come from France? And
what was that?
The men who hated you so much.
Oh, they were colonial French.
They were colonial
French. They were infantry and marine, and they had a mixture of everything. We had some foreign legionnaire there. Some were in foreign legion.
Yeah, but were they actually French, or were they German, or what?
Some I know were not French, but they had assumed the French nationality.
And they hated you just the same.
Yeah, they spoke with an Alsatian accent. You know, Alsatian used to be belong to this. So when you speak with a German accent in French, you are Alsatian.
Exactly. Alsace-Lorraine, yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So these men had to flee Indochina, go to France, and settle there, and that's where they died.
A lot of the French Foreign Legion were... we had a few Americans, like Lou Conin. So Lou was a Foreign Legionnaire.
Right.
Are you familiar with his funeral?
Not with his funeral, no.
He's buried in Arlington, and the funeral was a Legionnaire. Foreign Legionnaire funeral.
When did he actually die?
Oh, about 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, that's all. I would have thought longer than that.
Yeah. What was that?
I would have thought he passed away longer than that. But...
Oh, I bumped into Lou Conin many times in my army career. And Lou was quite a character, I tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, he certainly is famous.
Yeah, the first time I met him, he really straightened me out real good. I was at the Congressional Country Club, and this is, you know, it was taken over by OSS. And it turned out that I was given a room, and when I got into the room, I was the only one there. I took the lower bunk, you know, which was the best bunk, and pretty soon I was lying down on the bunk. Pretty soon I see this guy come in, and he says, "My name is Conin." I say, "What's your name?" He says, "Okay, that's me. By the way, I'm going to tell you something that you may not know." He said, "Do you ever heard this expression, R-H-I-P? I said, "No," he said. "It means rank has its privileges. You're supposed to sleep on the top of the bunk. I am sleeping on the bottom of the bunk." That was Lou Conin's instructions, my first instructions to me. I never dreamed then that he was going to save my life a couple of times.
And he turned out to be a good guy. You got along well.
Oh, he was a great guy. I love Lou. Lou was a great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, have you read my book?
You autographed two copies of Winking Fox and...
You haven't read them yet.
I have not read them. And tracks...
Now, what I told you is probably mentioned... I gave you more detail now that it's in the book.
No, I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And this will be transcribed and put into the archives, and I'll try to get you a copy. And what I'll do, Renee, is I'll send you a note today with my address. And if you send me that tape, I'll watch it. I promise I'll send it right back to you.
Yeah, you got. You know, that'll be a good for a class to show them this movie. It's 49 minutes, but it's worth it.
Absolutely.
It is a historical, well done by the BBC. And oh, by the way, I was interviewed by Ali North last month.
Oh, I didn't know that. For his war stories?
Yeah,
or
war story, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he spoke to me like you did about the French Resistance for approximately 2.5 hours.
Oh.
Then when I saw the show, he gave me only 42 seconds of fame.
Oh, that's not good. I promised to give you more than that.
No, I don't care.
No, I know.
I don't care. I'm kidding. He's a good interviewer, I tell you.
Oh, very interesting. But I mean what I said. They're going to get you out there in the spring when the weather is nicer.
Okay.
To come visit, and we'll take you to dinner in Newport and enjoy your stories in person.
I have a niece that lives in Bethesda.
I'm sorry, you have a niece that lives in Bethesda?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So we familiar with the place, with the area.
Well, I mean, Newport's a good what am I saying? Newport's a good...
What was that?
Newport, Rhode Island is a good 7-8 hours away.
Is that... Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So...
But it's okay. It's 7 hours.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, driving. It's about 7-8 hours from Washington to Newport, Rhode Island.
Wow.
I think you're thinking of Annapolis.
I didn't know what I was thought for.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, did I tell you about Porsche?
No. No.
Well, I don't remember who I talked to about Porsche. He used to be at the
The Naval War College?
Naval War College, yes.
No, I don't know who that is.
Yeah, it's where you are, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, Porsche was, and he wrote a nasty book about the French Resistance.
Oh.
And the French got very upset with him. Except I did. I agree with him.
You agreed with him.
I agree with him. What he says is absolutely the truth. But the French don't want to hear the truth. And a lot of Americans who were saved, supposedly saved by the resistance, hate the guy because he told the truth. You know, he said, this is the way the French resistance was, you know.
What's the name of the book?
Oh, what's the name of the book? Ooh, hold on a minute. Hold on. I had it on my fingertip. I will put it on the
send me an email. Absolutely.
I'll give you the address.
You recommend the book?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It is a good book. It was very interesting, very well documented, and I agree with what he says about the French Resistance. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I look forward to looking it up then.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Renee. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate that.
I'll send you that thing as soon as I get your address.
Absolutely, sir. We'll keep in touch. You have a happy Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.